This is Yolande Robinson, and welcome to Shifting Perspectives. Thank you for joining us this week. In this week's conversation, I'm joined by Dr. Karen Moss. Dr. Moss is a registered nurse who was born and raised in Nassau, Bahamas. She began her nursing career after obtaining an associate's degree at the University of the Bahamas. She has since gone on to complete a bachelor's degree in nursing at the Adventist University of Health Sciences in Orlando and her master's and PhD degrees at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Now, this week's conversation is a little bit different than some of the ones that we've been having on Shifting Perspectives. But then again, remember that this entire show is about perspectives. And today we're going to talk about one that I know a lot of us find uncomfortable at times. Dr. Moss is going to help us, touch the tip of the iceberg in terms of navigating the process of dying and death and even a little bit of grief. And so, like I said, although we're touching just the tip of the iceberg of this huge topic, I found that Dr. Moss shed such tremendous light on advanced care planning, healthcare decision making, and end of life decision making process, particularly in Blacks and African American adults living with dementias. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome, Dr. Moss. It's great to have you on Shifting Perspectives.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So firstly, I want to give you, as I do every guest, the opportunity to tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that drives you.
Wonderful. So as you mentioned, I am a registered nurse. I have been for several years now and just happen to be now an assistant professor at The Ohio State University. So that's kind of who I am on the professional realm. You talked about what I study as part of my program of research. Apart from that, I am a daughter, I am a wife, I am a mom of two wonderful children who are now 13 and 10 years old. As you also mentioned, I was born and raised in Nassau, Bahamas. This is who I am and what I bring to the table and what shapes and help to drive the research agenda that I am involved in, but with a connection to, yes, the professional and my professional experiences, both in the Bahamas as a nurse and also in the United States, but also staying grounded and connected through my familial experiences that first got me started in being interested first in nursing as a profession, interested in older adults and end of life planning.
Okay, well, let's jump into that familial connection and what got you interested in nursing. Where did that come from? How was it? Tell me the family connection.
Yeah, so I was in what we called junior high school, about eighth grade, when my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was diagnosed and subsequently died of colon cancer. So she lived about a year. And within that year, I was able to, go to the hospital and visit her on a daily basis when she was hospitalized, or, be at her house after school and, seeing the home health nurse come in and care for her. I actually ended up working with one of her home health nurses years later in the ICU in the Bahamas, a dear friend, colleague, mentor who we just recently lost. But it was through watching what the nurses did in the hospital setting, in the home care setting with my grandmother, that really sparked my interest in wanting to become a nurse. I later found out that it was my mother's dream to become a nurse herself, which I had not even known. So I feel like I'm kind of living her dream in a way. That really feels good. And it was, in this kind of unforced way, because I had no idea until after I'd made the decision. And so that sparked the initial interest in nursing And then, you know, just kind of watching the death and dying process and just being so intrigued by it. And still to this day, very much intrigued. I remember during my first nursing program and going to clinicals and, you know, always somehow ending up with a patient that was near death, end up passing away, often most times expectedly. And so I was kind of dubbed the death nurse. And, okay. You know, because always at post-conference, I got to share about, you know, these experiences of my patient passing away, whether they were coded or not. But, you know, just kind of got really comfortable a little bit with the death and dying process from a professional perspective.
Well, you know, that's so interesting because it's such a sensitive topic, you know, and even in, I'm so out of my depth in terms of this episode, and you are definitely going to have to take every hat of expert in this one, but it's death and dying is such a sensitive topic. And I think it's one that we stay away from a lot. And, you know, the fact that you've mentioned that it was intriguing to you and that, you know, when did you realize it was intriguing? How did that spark?
Yeah, so I think it was those first few days, you know, first few years, I should say, of, you know, being in clinicals, my first few years in nursing school, and, you know, a few years after. So I had my grandmother's death experience as one frame of reference, and then her brother, my granduncle, died several years later while I was already a nurse. And he ended up dying peacefully at home in his sleep of what we believe was natural causes.
Completely different circumstance.
Yeah. So she passed away in hospital. I do not believe that she ended up being coded, which was good because, you know, she was had terminal cancer at that point. But I look at the contrast between the death and dying experiences of both of these dear, dear loved ones. And I thought, I think I like the dying at home in my sleep better. I would choose that scenario if I had the opportunity. We don't get to choose, right?
Yeah.
To a certain extent, we may have the ability to, you know, make some decisions beforehand. If we're willing, that can, you know, influence these outcomes. If we're willing to have these conversations on the front end.
And that's the piece there is being willing to have the conversations.
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly this show is called Shifting Perspectives for a reason is, and I'm thankful that you're willing to openly bring this perspective into the show. And because with it being such a sensitive topic, do you find that it's even that whole idea of end of life care, is it even more of a sensitive topic amongst Black Americans and Caribbean communities? Do you notice that?
So absolutely. And it's reflected in the hesitancy that we see in terms of the planning. So healthcare systems, as an example, I'll give to you in the United States, the gold standard is basically having a documented form of an advance directive. So whether that's a living will that you had drawn up with an attorney, or it's a form that, you know, is hospital based that you can have even the secretary who is a part of a doctor's visit, you know, the doctor's office you walk into, be a witness to whatever your wishes are for care, health care near the end of life. And so oftentimes the likelihood that you find somebody who is Black versus, let's say, a white, and I'll talk in the sense of older adults because that's who I study, actually having that document in place in their records and being readily available to healthcare providers. The chances of having that document available to healthcare providers is much less if the person is Black or African American. And we know that there are issues around trust and the mistrust of healthcare systems that exist in the United States because of history. You know, when you think about things like the Tuskegee study that happened and creates this hesitancy, lack of trust within healthcare systems, that is a frame of reference. We do have slavery. You know, Tuskegee didn't occur in the Bahamas, right? But we have things like slavery that did occur across the world when it comes to Blacks in society. And so for whatever reason, you have this hesitancy to talk about or plan for the end of life. And because of who I am, because of where I was born, I have a vested interest in this population. So whether it's in the United States and I'm working with African Americans or Blacks or however folks identify themselves to be of the Black diaspora, or it's in my home country where I do hope to be able to extend this research to. You know, you have this notion that, you know, if you talk about it, maybe it'll happen sometimes. And this is very generalized information I should share because not, you can't take one, family or one individual and individual's perspective and say, okay, because this person belonged to this group, this is the way they think. And that's where we get into.
For sure. We're not trying to get into that kind of trouble. No. We're giving perspective.
Exactly. So we can get into trouble by making those assumptions, especially as healthcare providers. And we really should not do that. But when we think about, you know, ways that we can lend a helping hand and improve health outcomes, especially around the end of life. I think about, for example, pain management, which is another aspect of the work that I do. So if you think of when it comes to talking about end of life, certain things always come up, things like religiosity or spirituality. So if somebody is a religious person, that tends to come out. If they consider themselves to be spiritual, that tends to come out. Because no matter who we are, we all have a perspective about what's going to happen to us after we die. Yeah. Even if we think we're going to vanish in thin air and there is no soul to be left behind in any regard, we all have some perspective. And, you know, death and dying kind of brings that to the forefront. It makes us think, you know, when we think about our own mortality in that way, morbidity, we think about, you know, what's going to happen to us after that? What is going to happen? And, you know, there's certain kind of preparations. And even if you follow along, you know, if you think of just a family member in, you know, somebody that you know that would have passed away, we always go back and we think, oh my gosh, this person said this or this happened, you know, in relation to that. And you're like, oh my gosh, what was this? What does this really mean? What did this mean in that moment? And it, you know, it kind of goes into this whole notion of preparation, which is, you know, partly why it's so fascinating to me when we sit back and we think about these experiences. Mm-hmm. But, you know, going back to, you know, why, you know, the conversation and it being taboo. And I think it's because of these negative experiences that we are often exposed to surrounding death and dying. I've fortunately been a part of, you know, my uncle's experience that was very peaceful, not being physically present when he passed away, but to be able to reflect on that gives a sense of peace. And I think that for our family caregivers who are involved in caring for loved ones near the end of life, when they get to sit and reflect and think about what that experience was like, it's going to shape how they plan for their own death and dying. So, you know, whether good, bad, or indifferent, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to inform. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about, you know, how do we even broach having these very difficult conversation, we all have a personal experience with death that that is a starting point. So yes, if it's a good experience that we have or, you know, with a loved one, that's wonderful. If it's a bad experience, well, we can start there too.
Yeah. And you work know, from so, there in terms
yeah,
of, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's interesting what you say in terms of the, you know, the trust or sometimes mistrust of the healthcare system and how things have evolved. And what I was thinking of as you were saying it is sometimes there's a mistrust or an uncertainty. And it's been passed down generationally. We're not even sure why it is the way it is. You know how you tracked it back to saying the Tuskegee and, you know, and slavery and whatnot. And I think a lot of times there's feelings there that are just there, but individuals don't know where they come from. So I think it's great when we have researchers that can step in and take what that research is and what is coming out and put it in forms that the everyday person can benefit from and use to make informed decisions going forward.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as I work in this space and, you know, I engage with physician colleagues and anthropologists whom I love, you know, social workers who are really closely involved in this work. They bring this notion, this interdisciplinary notion of being able to pull out these various aspects of this research that mm-hmm. lend to these different things that you were just referencing. And I think it's a good example of collaboration that we get to bring different perspectives into this conversation, because, you know, it's definitely something that is interdisciplinary. We need our physician mm-hmm. colleagues mm-hmm. to be a part of this, because they are, you know, having these one-on-one conversations. You know, there's other disciplines that are expert and can do the follow-up and can help to continue these conversations. And so the work that I am proposing to be able to do will hopefully lend to an intervention or a program, if you will, that will mm-hmm. help to be able to do that.
That's exciting stuff, though.
It is.
That's really, congratulate that. You know, I get excited about research. But tell me about that transition mm-hmm. from nursing to research. When did you make that switch?
Yeah. So just to be clear, I have never left nursing.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. When did you go into nurse, research aspect. To the plate?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is a very good question. So it was actually while I was working in Central Florida when I was kind of tapped by a mentor to apply for a PhD program. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll look at that later, because I was at that point working on my bachelor's degree. And, you know, I was for the application for the program, I was required to write about, or, you know, talk about what I intend to study. And I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm intrigued. You know, I was working in the ICU at that time, and I'm, you know, greatly intrigued still by death and dying. And I thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to study death and dying in African Americans or Blacks. And that's what I went in the door, you know, kind of on my agenda after working with a mentor who did caregiving research in Alzheimer's disease, actually dementia, understanding that Alzheimer's is just one of the many forms of dementia. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I, you know, just kind of went off and ran with that. Later learned that, you know, Blacks are twice more likely than Caucasians to even develop this disease. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think we tend to forget that dementia, you know, it is a terminal disease. It mm-hmm. impacts our powerhouse, our brain. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, how can we not assist these family caregivers with all that they are already have on their plates? Yeah. How can we not help them, help to prepare them for this process in some mm-hmm. way, shape, or form? And so that was kind of my entree into nursing research.
Right. So, you know, you started to tell us about your research. Tell us a little more in terms of, for you, what is your ultimate goal that you want to see come out of this research?
Yeah, so my legacy as it relates to this, so I look at the potential to influence these outcomes. When I say influence, to improve them, to help folks have better end-of-life experiences. Yes, for the mm-hmm. individual themselves, but also the family that they leave behind.
Their circles, because, yeah.
You know, depending on what your belief system is, we can differ on what, and when I say your, even our listeners, mm-hmm. we can mm-hmm. differ on what we think happens to that person, their soul after death. But for that loved one, we know with certainty that they're left behind, and they're left to grapple with, you know, whether or not their loved one was, they were with their loved one, they were holding their hand, whether or not their loved one was at peace, mm-hmm. Whether or not they were comfortable and not in pain, whether or not they were short of breath or gasping for air. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about, and I think, unfortunately or fortunately, the current pandemic that we're in creates yes. this backdrop. And I'm in the midst of collecting data for a couple of my studies, and one of them is heavily focused on advanced care planning or end-of-life preparation. And you have this backdrop and everything that I just described of whether or not you're able to be with your loved one.
Wow.
That's just not able to happen.
Right? There's just so much has been shaken in the last year in relation to, and it's touched everything and, and I'm sure affects the conversation tremendously.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we think about, you know, the ability to be there or to not be there and how we can, as best we can, influence that, I'm sure these family members who walk away from these experiences are going to have a renewed perspective. Hard as it was, like I mentioned earlier, that's going to influence how they make decisions for themselves. So to within a degree, we can plan all we want, right? But pandemic is going to happen or, you know, a sudden sudden illness and immediate death is going to happen. But outside of that, what is it that we can do to better assist these individuals so that the stress, the trauma, the grief that they're going to go through is lessened? So it's more manageable. How can we help them even in the aftermath? So we think about, yes, making decisions with whether or not to have CPR done or be on a ventilator, depending on what's going on, depending on what outcomes look like, or, you know, versus being at home, dying peacefully with pain well managed, that sort of stuff, breathlessness under control versus, you know, the other possibilities, and thinking about how we can even assist those caregivers, these family members, even after death to, you know, as they transition and go through that grieving process. Because, you know, as societies, we are acculturated to, you know, a loved one dies, suddenly even, you know, tragic deaths as well included, you know, you pick back up and you just, you know, you have a day or two.
Get your couple days and that's,
and you go back to work and you get back on that horse and you just keep on riding. So, you know, a lot of us walk around with a lot of this unresolved grief. And so until it happens again, it's kind of layered on and layered on. And, you know, even healthcare providers, you have healthcare providers who oftentimes are resistant to even go there. You know, they'll tell you, I'm here to help save your life, not to end it, you know, and nobody's asking somebody to end a person's life. But if their wishes are that they don't have additional intervention to help prolong life and allow the death and dying process to occur naturally, that is a perspective that we need to be able to honor, irregardless of our personal experiences or lack of, you know, dealing with our own issues with death and dying, unresolved grief. And so, you know, when we talk about patients and families and this happening, particularly in my case with my work in dementia, there's an aspect of this that, you know, healthcare providers are hugely important to this role also. And so my legacy, back to your big question, my legacy that I would like to leave is to be able to offer a program that will be community-centric, so community-based, not necessarily attached to large medical center or the hospital environment, creating a space where folks can show up and have these conversations, or somebody like myself can show up and assist these individuals with these conversations in the privacy of their own home, at their kitchen table, on their terms. Oftentimes what you find,
when they feel safe and secure when they can connect with somebody to help them through a process.
And to that end, we oftentimes have these instances where, you know, and I've seen it in my career, where you will have mom or dad with adult children, and mom is just tired. You know, she has a terminal illness and she is just ready to to move on. She's ready to transition. She is not comfortable broaching this with her adult children. And so she doesn't, if she's even awake and aware enough to do that. Right. And then on the other hand, you have the adult, you have scenarios where you have these adult children who see, you know, are observing their parent, their loved one, suffering essentially, struggling with pain or to breathe. And they within themselves are thinking, just make it stop. She's suffering. Let's not do this anymore. But do not have the words, do not have the wherewithal to share that with each other, much less to the individual. And so that we're, you know, in that, in those scenarios, they're really, families are really depending on healthcare providers to broach these conversations. But oftentimes we're dealing with strangers, right? So, you know, from showing up to healthcare systems, typically your doctor who you see in the community is not the one who's going to see you in the hospital. And so how do you have these conversations at these, you know, during these hard times, you know, so we need to do a better job of having these beforehand. You know, yes, when things are, when folks are healthy, it's more ideal. Sure. But who wants to talk about it then? Because things are good and everybody's happy. You know, we used to say, have these conversations at the dining room table at Thanksgiving or at Christmas, but who wants to go down that road at Christmas and Thanksgiving? I know. We want to eat and drink and be merry.
But I can see why it would be, you know, so beneficial to have those kinds of programs there that people can tap into. Yes. And how impactful that your research can be, not only in the community that you're in, but worldwide.
That's the goal. That's the goal. Okay. Yeah.
Awesome. Now, you've already started speaking a little bit more about dealing specifically with families with dementia. When you look at this specific population, how is this different for caregivers and this population from your perspective?
So remember, you know, with dementia, one of the biggest challenges. So, you know, I think in terms of older adults in general, so you have the general aging scenario at play. So where there's the physical decline, mom or dad or grandma or grandpa is going to need help with just their activities of daily living, you know, taking a bath, maybe walking, that sort of thing. With Alzheimer's disease or any of the forms of dementia, you get the cognitive decline as well. And so people often talk about, you know, losing their loved one twice. So they lose them first when their memory is gone and they no longer know who they are or have to be reminded every time of who they are, or they're assuming they're somebody else when they're not. And so there's that disconnect. So mom or dad who's there in the physical sense still is not mom or dad anymore.
Right. And so
that's, there's grief even in that, when that physical loss has not even occurred yet. And then you have, you know, the actual physical loss when, you know, they die. And so, you know, this is kind of unique to, you know, any of the forms of dementia, that's different from our typical aging process and, you know, moving towards death and dying. The struggles that come with adapting, adjusting, realizing that mom and dad just is not mom or dad anymore. And on top of that, don't recognize me as being their precious child anymore. You know, how do you grapple with that? And then all of the behavioral signs and symptoms that can come along with the disease, you know, trying to keep them safe and not, you know, safe from wandering into danger, opening door, unlocking doors during the night. And
those realities.
Those realities and going missing. And so these are just some of the things that, you know, these caregivers have to grapple with, and oftentimes without the necessary resources. So support systems in place to help provide. And that's, you know, the social support from other family and also healthcare resources that are often lacking or out of reach for many of the population that I work with.
So clearly this work has great impact on helping people through this grieving process. You know, and I think speaking about grief in this period, having, you know, the fact that we've been dealing with this pandemic for almost a year now. And I think everybody in some way, shape or form has had to experience some grief, right? You know, whether it is for the populations that you're primarily working with or in general, what words do you have for people about making their way through the grieving process?
That's an excellent question. And actually one of the things we talk about in, you know, discussing grief and loss and when we train other healthcare providers about it is the best thing that we can do is listen. Mm-hmm. So be that air, allow mm-hmm. people to share and share openly about how they feel, mm-hmm. About the challenges without judgment.
That's a huge piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. And so, you know,
and I think sometimes people don't even realize that they're doing the judgment, you know, but yeah.
Verbally or non-verbally, right?
yes. Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So being there, you know, a lot of us know people who are in the caregiving role, you know, and it doesn't have to be necessarily with dementia, who maybe would have lost a family member, a loved one during this time. You know, the sense of community, we got to check in on each other. We got to mm-hmm. check in on each other and just say, hey, how you doing? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How you doing? And we always, you know, tend to think, you know, let me know if I can do something for you. No, just do it.
Because, I agree with you. 100%.
You know, you meet certain personalities and you know them. You're probably one of them, right? So you'll never ask for help. Yeah. This is very, very typical caregiver characteristic. They're never going to say when they need help. You know, so the onus is upon us as members of the community to reach out and say, hey, I'm going to do this for you. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a break today.
Yeah.
You go off, you get some rest, you do whatever, take a bubble bath, whatever.
Whatever it is.
I got you for today or mm-hmm. a couple hours or whatever it is that you can do mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to help that individual. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, folks dealing with grief and loss during this time, I think the best thing we can do for them is be there, be that support, listen. I know it's hard because we can't get together in person. I mean, we mm-hmm. have tons and tons of funerals occurring, either yeah. socially distanced or virtually, and it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard, mm-hmm. especially when you live in a different country. You know, mm-hmm. I totally get mm-hmm. that. I've had losses in my own family and not being able to travel for funeral services. But however we can be in touch with each other throughout the day, you know, just a quick text if you can, mm-hmm. if that's all you're able to do to check in and say, hey, how's it going?
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
Thank you for picking up
the phone to call. Let's not forget that.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's one too, is the quick text is good.
Yeah.
But because we're so distant right now, I think hearing that voice can make such a difference. You know?
Yes.
So,
and then we have the wonderful option of video chatting.
Yes.
You know, which is like the best thing, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. definitely we're definitely making this technology work for us in this period.
Absolutely.
So, well, you know, I thank you so much for sharing so much of your knowledge with us and the direction that you're going with your research. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we close up?
You know, I'm extremely appreciative for you inviting me to be here and to share. I think one of the things that I am really grateful of the prospect of, you know, I shared with you what I hope my legacy to be in this space mm-hmm. will end up becoming. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, I cannot mention any of, you know, the work that I've done, the work that I'm doing, the work that I will do, and its successes and future successes. You know, I owe a great deal to God. Mm-hmm. You know, I cannot not mention that. My family, mm-hmm. Parents, siblings, nieces, nephews, you name it, children, my mm-hmm. spouse, my husband, you know, who've all been on this journey with me, and I'm so grateful for it. Continue to learn from each of them in so many ways, and they help to shape who I am mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and help me just to do what I'm doing. And I'm just really, really grateful to be in this space and to be able to conduct this work for my mentors and colleagues who continue to support me as well. Just ever grateful, being on uncharted territory, but just looking forward to being able to have that ultimate impact in helping these patients and families to prepare better for the end of life and, you know, just continue to pass that on. And hopefully even coming out of such a grim situation with the pandemic, mm-hmm. we'll all emerge better, more mm-hmm. willing to have these conversations and just lead to better quality of life for all of us.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And we wish you all the best with every venture and can't wait to hear more about it as you get further and deeper into your research or the programs that come out of it, certainly.
Thank you
for joining us on this week's episode of Shifting Perspectives. If you'd like to get in touch with Dr. Karen Moss or find out any more about what she's doing, you can visit this week's show page at www.yolandrobinson.com/episode39. Have an awesome week.